Dean.
Probably the one that's most familiar, if you think about it a lot, is Remember Amalek, right? Zachor Eis Asher Asach Amalek. Another is Remember the Shabbat Day to keep it holy. And this applies even during the week. You might ask, how do I remember Shabbat during the week? Well, if you remember, first of all, remember the old argument in Shammai and Hillel? That everything Shammai bought, he bought in honor of Shabbat. Meaning, if he saw a nice piece of food, he would buy it for Shabbat, and he wouldn't eat it until he found something better, in which case he would buy the second thing for Shabbat and eat the first thing. So every purchase Shammai made was always the Kavod Shabbat, because he wouldn't use it until he had something better. Now Hillel's attitude was, Baruch Hashem Yom Yom, one should trust in God every single day, one shouldn't worry on Sunday about Shabbat, as it were, you take life as it comes. But even Hillel talked about the notion of remembering the Shabbat during the week. And there's one striking way that we do remember Shabbat during the week, and Nachmanides points this out. He points out that we do not have distinct names for the days of the week. We don't have a Hebrew term for Sunday or Monday or Tuesday. What do we call Sunday? Yom Rishon. But that's only part of the name. The official name of the day is Yom Rishon La Shabbat. The first day towards Shabbat. It's the second day towards Shabbat. The third day towards Shabbat. And Nachmanides writes that the reason Jews count the weeks, the days of the week that way, is that every single day we should be thinking about Shabbat. That is the idea of remembering Shabbat. And of course, in an ultimate sense, the purpose of Shabbat is not in and of itself, but the purpose of Shabbat is to transform the week. So that's so remembering Amalek, remembering Shabbat. But another remembrance appears in this parsha, and that is, remember the day that we stood before God on Mount Sinai and we received the Torah. This is a zechira. Let me see if I can find the actual verse in which that zachar is used. Yes, it doesn't say it in the positive sense, but if you look at chapter 4, verse 9, it expresses it in the negative sense. This is chapter 4, verse 9. Hishomer lecha, Hishomer lecha means be very careful, Ushmor nafshecha miod, and guard your soul, Hen tishkach es hadvarim, lest you forget the words or the events, Asher ra'u einecha, that your own eyes have seen, Upen yasuru milvavcha kol yimei chayecha, and lest it depart from your heart all the days of your life. Va'odatam rivanecha v'levnecha, you shall make them known to your children and your children's children. What should you make known? Verse 10. Yom asher amadata lifnei Hashem Elokecha b'chorev. Remember the day that you stood before God on Mount Chorev. And of course you know, Mount Chorev is one of the synonyms or one of the other names for Sinai. In fact, the first appearance of Har Chorev was in last week's Torah reading. If you remember, Moses was wandering and the burning bush, let's look at it, was adjacent to Mount Chorev, which is Mount Sinai, right? So that was the actual mountain which Moses later received, Moshe Rabbeinu later received the Torah. So there is a zechira to remember what is called Ma'amad Har Sinai, the revelation at Sinai. And Moshe, and of course it's an interesting thing, that although Moshe is talking to these people and saying, remember the day you stood by Sinai, a lot of these people were not born yet. Remember, the Sinai revelation was 40 years before, but we know that the rabbis have a mystical tradition that in fact every soul of every Jew that is born in the future was present at Kabbalat HaTorah. And even the souls of, in fact, Kabbalistically, that is the idea of the convert. You know, people say, what type, if you have to have a Jewish soul, how does a Jew by choice acquire a Jewish soul, so to speak? And the explanation that's given is that the soul of the Ger was present at Mount Sinai. It's a very interesting way they explain it. You know, there's a famous midrash that says that before God gave the Torah at Mount Sinai, he went to all the nations of the world, and he offered them the Torah first. And all the nations of the world turned it down because there was something in the Torah which they didn't like. So God went to the Ishmael, the Arabs, and there it says, don't steal, whatever it is, and they couldn't accept that. He went to Esav, the Edomites, it says, don't kill, they couldn't accept that. He went to Bnei Yisrael said, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do. But here's the question. What if, for example, a nation rejected the Torah by a majority of, let's say, 51% to 49%, but what happened to that 49% minority? Or, even if it was 98% rejection, what happened to the 2% minority? The answer is, they are the souls of those people who eventually link up to the Jewish people in the form of conversion or geirut. So the mystical explanation of the soul of the ger is the soul of the ger was always a Jewish soul, in the sense that this was a dissenter of the Umot HaOlam who did not accept the Torah.
It begins to sound like a beautiful nefesh transmigration of souls thing.
Absolutely,
how,
yeah.
Yes, and how embedded is that in our tradition? Where does that fit in? Where does it come from? You don't necessarily have a disposition on this thing I want to, but I'm curious if you brought it up with this.
Well, you know, we would not describe this, you know, as an article of faith, so to speak. It's not, you know, canonized in any sense. It basically comes from the influence of Kabbalah. For example, the Talmud has virtually no references to the concept of reincarnation, nor does the Midrash. But the Zohar develops it, and of course the Ari, the Arianic Kabbalah, made transmigration of souls a very, very major aspect of its theology and philosophy. I will say that Nachmanides, who lived in the 13th century, and he was much earlier than Lurianic Kabbalah, also uses Gilgal, reincarnation and transmigration of souls, as a possible explanation for why the righteous suffer, which of course corresponds exactly to the Buddhist idea that you know, we sometimes suffer, or the Hindu idea rather, that we sometimes suffer because of the sins we've committed in the other world, and we have to keep on coming back till we get it right. Well, Nachmanides articulates the identical idea. So it certainly finds a resonance in the Jewish tradition, but I would not say that, you know, you're a bad Jew if you don't accept that. And of course, you know, there's fascinating scientific work in past life regression under hypnosis and the like, which suggests certain possibilities of previous existences that we might not be aware of. Again, it's a very interesting, exactly whether this work is valid or not. There's disagreement in the scientific community, but it does raise some interesting ideas of the possibilities of reincarnation.
Yeah. There's a problem of Yesh Brera. If the 2% of the nations who, if 2% of the nation that would have accepted the Torah, that 2% appeared at Sinai, it would seem to be that they had no Brera but to appear at Sinai and eventually become Jewish.
Well, you know, you're raising a very, very tricky question. Nobody forced them to accept the Torah, though. Their soul volitionally made that commitment. Now, obviously, once your soul commits, you know, you're led down a certain path. But initially, it was an act of will. And I should also emphasize, too, that at most, the Sinai covenant, you know, imprints in the soul certain tendencies, but there is still free will to rebel against them. Just as a Jew, let's think every Jew. Every Jew was clearly at Sinai, according to our tradition, and yet a Jew retains the freedom to rebel against the Torah. So I would say, kal v'chomer, a fortiori, that would apply to the 2% minority. They have the same freedom to reject as a Jew has. And in fact, they're better off in a way, because as you know, a non-Jew who doesn't convert to Judaism has committed no wrong, right? I mean, there's no aveira in a non-Jew not becoming Jewish, as opposed to a Jew who doesn't follow the Torah. That's something that's considered to be improper. So, you know, so as I say, the imprinting of certain tendencies in the soul does not create a coercive situation. But of course, even at Matan Torah itself, I'm sure you've heard the passage of the Talmud that's a little problematical. That it says in Exodus that the Jews stood under the mountain and they heard God's voice. And there's a passage in the Talmud that takes it very literally, that God held the mountain over their heads and said, okay, you people have a choice. Accept the Torah is wonderful, and if not, I'm dropping the mountain. So as you would expect, the Jews said, sure, well, we accept it. So one of the big questions is, if Kabbalat HaTorah is described as something into which God coerced the Jewish people, number one, why do the Jewish people, you know, get some credit for the Naseh and Ishma, we will do and we will listen? They were forced into it. Number two, isn't it unfair that the Umot HaOlam weren't forced into it? In other words, what do we say? The Jewish people did something better than the Umot HaOlam because they said no and we said yes. Yeah, but they said no because they didn't have the mountain over their head and we had the mountain. And number three, the question is, how can a Kabbalah meaning an acceptance, be binding if it was procured under duress or compulsion? After all, if I enter into a contract, somebody goes over to me and says, sign on the dotted line or I'm shooting or I'm pulling the trigger, that's not a contract, right? That's a contract under duress. Now, in fact, the Gemara makes a striking comment. The Gemara says, you know, the Jews had a real good excuse. The Jews would be able to freely renounce the Torah because they were forced into it, but we lost that chance at Purim time, because our Chachamim have a drasha that says at Purim time, in gratitude of God's salvation, the Jewish people re-accepted the Torah out of love, while prior to that, the Torah had been accepted out of fear. And this is the drasha and the words. It says at the end of the scroll of Esther, Megillat Esther, Ki yamu v'kiblu. They accepted and they assumed upon themselves. So what's the repetition? They accepted anew what they had assumed upon themselves before. One was duress and one was ava. So, you know, if you lived before the story of Purim, you could have argued we were forced into it. But at this point, we cannot say that anymore. But that's one interpretation. But the Maharal gives another interpretation, the Maharal of Prague, which I think is a very, very valuable insight. Again, the question is, how can the Jewish people be bound to obey the Torah if they were forced into it? And why is it so great for them to say Naseh v'Nishma if it was because the mountain was over their head? And the Maharal says, God did not hold the mountain over their head until after they accepted the Torah willingly. In other words, do you accept the Torah? They said, yes, of our own free will. And then God held the mountain over their heads. The question then becomes, so what's the point? The Maharal says, the point of holding the mountain over their head was not to force them into acceptance. They already accepted. But it was to indicate to them the momentous importance of their decision to the nature and future of the world. God created this universe so that there should be a Torah in the world. Now again, however you understand that, I understand there may be different theological views, but be it as it may, even if you define Torah in the broadest sense, or perhaps the broadest sense, of the moral principles that govern the universe, the world comes into existence only because there will at least be one nation that is committed to the Torah. If there would not have been a Kabbalat HaTorah, the Jewish people would have said no, and they were the last on the list. The world would have been destroyed. So the point is this. It wouldn't make sense for God to coerce the acceptance because the whole point of acceptance is voluntary. But after they accept, God says, you don't know how lucky you are, because if you wouldn't have made that commitment, the universe as a whole, symbolized by the mountain over their heads, would have no justification. In other words, it's a very, very interesting insight, meaning the point is not coercion. The point is to demonstrate in retrospect how momentous and important Kabbalat HaTorah is for humanity as a whole. And in fact, Rashi makes this point in the Chumash earlier, in the book of Bereishit, at the end of the creation of the 6 days. It says, Vayihi Erev, Vayihi Boker, it was an evening, it was a morning, and that, by the way, of course, you know, is the source why Jewish days begin from the night before, like Shabbat begins Friday night, Erev, night, and then Boker. But it says, Yom HaShishi, the 6 day. Now Rashi raises the question, it never has that hey, that definite article, in front of any of the other days. There's Yom Echad, Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi, Yom Revi'i, Yom Chamishi. But all of a sudden, it doesn't say Yom Shishi, Yom HaShishi. It was the sixth day. What is the sixth day? So Rashi quotes a Midrash that the sixth day does not refer only to the sixth day of creation, but it refers to the sixth day of Sivan. That's the day of Shavuot, the day that the Torah was given. Meaning, God said, as it were, this world, whose creation was completed on day six, is not fully justified until Yom HaShishi, till the sixth day of Sivan, because the world was created only that there should be a Torah in the world. And the Maharal of Prague explains that is the significance of the mountain. The mountain over their head was not to coerce them into accepting the Torah, but to inform them after they accepted the Torah that this is the importance of what a person does. In fact, there's yet another answer to this question. There's an answer from the Midrash Tanchuma. The Midrash actually asks the question, if the Jews were forced into it, why can't they get out of it? And the Midrash Tanchuma gives a different answer than the Maharal. Midrash Tanchuma says there's a difference between the written Torah and the oral Torah. You know, our Torah is comprised of two parts. The Torah Shebiktav, the written law, are the words of the Chumash. And the oral law, which now, by the way, is largely written, the Talmud and the like, explains and elaborates on the oral, on the written law. Well, the Midrash Tanchuma says the Jews were willing to accept the written Torah, but they didn't want to accept the oral Torah, that they had to be forced into it. What's the difference? Because the Midrash Tanchuma says the written Torah gives a person a lot more latitude than the oral Torah. For example, the written Torah says, don't do work in Shabbat. Well, all right. So I won't go to my job on Shabbat, but I'll go to the mall, or I'll go to the beach, or I'll go to the movies. Right? Don't do work, right? But the oral Torah says, what is work? You know, don't cook, don't start a fire, you know, all these things. So the oral Torah creates a structure that in a way, well, it's paradoxically, the Midrash describes it as more rigid than the written Torah. Although, if you think, keep in mind the example of the Karaim and the Sadducees, one could argue the oral law creates a more flexible structure, because remember, the Sadducees who did not believe in the written Torah, the oral Torah, and they took the written Torah literally, they sat in darkness on Shabbat, because the Torah says, you shall not have fires, but the oral tradition says, thou shalt not start a fire, but one can have fires previously. So be it as it may, but the Midrash Tanchuma differentiates between the oral and the written law. So in terms of this central question, how do you reconcile the mountain over their heads with voluntary acceptance? So we've given three answers. The Talmud's answer is, yeah, they first got forced into it, but Purim time, they re-accepted out of love. Of course, that raises a lot of questions. How could there be a destruction of the temple or an exile, as it were, if we weren't technically bound? The Maharal's answer is, the mountain did not coerce the acceptance, but the mountain came afterwards to demonstrate the magnitude and importance of their decision. And the third answer is the Midrash Tanchuma that differentiates between the written law and the oral law. So there are different answers about this. But be it as it may, it is certainly very explicit in the Torah that we are supposed to think about the revelation at Sinai all the time. And as I mentioned in the Siddur, it is actually one of the zechirot, one of the six things that we always remember. Let's see if I can mention all of them. We have Amalek, we have Shabbat, we have Har Sinai. We are supposed to remember what God did to Miriam when she was in the desert. Now what is that referring to? When she spoke Lashon Hara against her brother Moshe, she was stricken with leprosy. And we remember that essentially to remind ourselves to watch what we say. Now, of course, needless to say, Lashon Hara is probably, or the observance of the laws against derogatory speech, is probably one of the hardest mitzvot in the entire Torah. I'm sure all of you know that even if what you say is true about someone, it is considered to be Lashon Hara, unless there are specific justifications. Now again, we understand there are times in which derogatory communication might be necessary, and of course teachers are primary people. For example, let's assume you have to tell a parent that a child did something improper, or a parent needs to confer with the teacher about disruptive behavior, or with a psychologist, or a social worker. It's very, very clear that the laws against Lashon Hara do not prohibit those types of communications. And in the language of Halakha, because these are communications litoelet, for a positive, constructive purpose to enhance the welfare of the child or the classroom. So there is certainly a recognition in Halakha that sometimes you have to disclose derogatory information about other people, whether it be children. And by the way, implicit in my example is there is a prohibition of Lashon Hara against children. We sometimes think, you know, our kids are our property, so we can say about them what we will. Absolutely not the case. You cannot say Lashon Hara about your own child unless it falls within the parameters of justification to doctor, therapist, teacher, in other words, someone with a need to know in order to help the child. And of course what that means is the communications must be limited to those with a need to know and should not go beyond the narrowest range of people that need to know. Tough, Vav, Ayin, Lamed, Tough, Litoelet, for a positive, constructive purpose. So that's an important point. See, the reason why Lashon Hara is a difficult area of Jewish law is because sometimes you're not allowed to say, and sometimes you must say. In other words, you very rarely have the liberty of saying, I'll just be strict on this one. Because sometimes there's a duty to speak up. Again, the examples are legion, and we could give obviously a whole courses can be given in Lashon Hara, well not in Lashon Hara, what not to say. We could certainly give a course in Lashon Hara, that's simple enough. For example, this comes up a lot in matchmaking. Shiduchim is of course a major, major area. Let's assume that somebody calls you and they're interested in meeting a young man or a young woman, and you know some information about the men, perhaps they've had psychiatric treatments, or they have a physical illness, or they're wife abusers, or the like, or they're bank robbers, or serial murderers, or the like. Now, obviously there are easy cases. I mean, I'm going from the obvious to the absurd. If somebody wants to go out with a man, and I know the man's been convicted of serial murder, of course, Mike, I am obligated to tell the person no. But there are a lot of difficult cases. What if somebody, you know, had depression, or some breakdown, a nervous breakdown in college 10 years earlier, but they have been treated with medication and it's under control? Like, you know, do you mention that, or do you say, well, I really shouldn't say it because these things seem to be okay? Of course, the issue is should the person themselves disclose it? That's one question. But what if I know it? Should I disclose it? Right, so these are very, very difficult issues which require a very sensitive judgment as to probability and, you know, of reoccurrence, and you have to put yourself in that uncomfortable position. But the point is, the most I could say at this juncture is one must be very ethically sensitive as to when is disclosure appropriate and when does it come into Lashon Hara. Can a religious Jew be a journalist, be a reporter? What do reporters do? Reporters uncover all sorts of derogatory information. Now, good, listen, if you're going to write a book about the environment or whatever it is, you know, that's okay. But can you write a restaurant review that's negative? Can you explore the private lives of politicians, as is done presently, which results in embarrassing and humiliating information, even if it's true?
Does it matter if the subject is Jewish or not? If a religious Jew is writing about a politician who's not Jewish, are the laws still binding them?
Well, the laws are a little less severe, meaning to say, certainly one can never lie, that's absolutely the case. Technically, the laws of Lashon Hara do not apply in full force vis-a-vis non-Jews. However, there is the parallel idea of Chilul Hashem, which is desecration of God's name, meaning to do things which are derogatory can cast the Jewish people into disrepute. Let me share with you, though, a very interesting point. The analytical framework in which a Jewish reporter would have to put his profession would be, is there a toelet? Is there a constructive need for the public to know this information? That's the question. Now, if I am a reporter and I have evidence that so-and-so has been taking bribes and has been awarding contracts to high bidders or the like, there clearly is a toilet for the public to know that this is a person that is not carrying out his duties in a proper way. However, let's assume I have uncovered evidence of adultery or infidelity or personal incidents. The question then becomes, you see, is there a legitimate need for the general public to know that one of their political leaders is not living an exemplary moral life? Now, you could argue that. Again, you see, it's not a clear-cut case. One could argue that morality is not compartmentalized. Right? And one could argue that if a person is immoral to their covenant of marriage, let us say, then that would suggest political dishonesty as well. On the other hand, perhaps not, right? In other words, sometimes people might be very proper in the carrying out of their official duties in spite of what they do, after hours or during hours or before hours. Now, let me share with you, and do you want to have a comment? Yeah. Let me share with you a comment that I found in a Sefer that was written 500 years ago, the Sefer HaIkarim, one of the primary works on Jewish philosophy. Actually, there's a very, very nice English translation of it as well in the library here. Sefer, the Book of Fundamentals, HaIkarim. This was written by Rav Yosef Albo. Very, very nice book. In other words, he takes Maimonides' 13 principles and he says there's really only three. You don't have to deal with 13. And the three are Mitziyut Hashem, there is a God, Sechar V'Onesh, there is ultimate reward and punishment, and third is Mamad Har Sinai, there is revelation. So essentially, God, reward and punishment, revelation. These are the three Ikarim of Judaism. Everything else is called Anafim. Anafim are branches. Anyway, the nice thing about the Sefer Ikarim is that in the middle of his explanation of these Ikarim, he's actually a very astute biblical commentator. He actually explains many stories in the Bible. And one of the things he explains is he raises the question, how come Shaul HaMelech does not get a second chance when he messes up? And King David, keeps on getting these extensions. For example, Shaul was told to kill Amalek. And Shaul spared, if you remember, the king of Amalek, Agag. So God immediately tells him, you're gone, you're out of here. This is it. I have given your kingdom to someone better than you, and that is King David. Now, Saul hobbled along for a little while longer, but essentially his reign was over from that point onwards. No second chance. Now, when King David takes Bathsheba, good, so the rabbis say it technically wasn't adultery because they say the husband gave her a divorce. There's a rabbinic interpretation that it wasn't as bad as it looked, but it's described as pretty bad. And Natan the Navi goes to King David and gives him the famous mashal about the rich man and the poor man. And the poor man had one little sheep and the rich man has everything. And the rich man takes the little sheep and has nothing. What should be done to such a selfish, cruel person? And David cries out, such a person deserves to die. And Natan points to David and says, Atah ha'ish.
You are the man.
You are that man. And many, many things happened. David certainly suffered tremendously. If you remember, Bathsheba was carrying his child. The child died. And the whole rebellion of Absalom was considered to be a consequence of the punishment. So David didn't get off scot-free. We're not suggesting that. But the one thing that was not taken away from him or his descendants was the Malchut. Now granted, in King Solomon's time, there was a rebellion. And there was the establishment of the northern kingdom, a breakaway of 10 tribes. But still, the Beit HaMikdash remains in the southern kingdom. And Mashiach will come from David. So in other words, the Davidic monarchy is still the ultimate monarchy. So the Sefer HaIkarim asks the question, why is it that David is given a second chance and Shaul is not given a second chance? He offers two answers. And I think both of these answers could really literally appear in the editorial page of a newspaper today. Answer number one, the nature of the sin was different. Shaul's sin was malfeasance in the performance of his executive responsibility. As king, he was given a job to do, eradicate Amalek. He failed in the fulfillment of his political duty. Failure in one's political duties is a legitimate grounds for removal. David's failure was not in the execution of his office, but it was a personal moral failure, very serious, but it was a personal sin. And the Sefer HaYikarim says the commission of personal sin is not necessarily a reason to disqualify you from political office. Isn't that amazing? In other words, you could apply this to the issue. Now, this is very relevant on Lashon Hara, because if we say that personal sins do not necessarily compromise political leadership, even in a Jewish king who is supposed to be an exemplar, then it would appear that it is Lashon Hara to reveal. That's one answer. But let me give you the second answer, which cuts the opposite direction. The second answer, I'm not sure if he says it or other commentaries say it, is the following. The difference is not the nature of the sin. The difference is the nature of the response when they are called on it and confronted with it. Remember the book of Shmuel. When Shaul is confronted with his sin, if you remember, Shaul tries to pass the buck, assign blame to other people. Shaul, well, first he denies it. First of all, Shaul says, "What's the problem? I killed everybody." He denies the accusation. Shmuel says, "No, you didn't." So when denial doesn't work, he passes the buck. He says, "The people demanded the sheep. What could I do?" Of course, ignoring that the king was spared. Well, that's another issue. That's another issue. But the point is, though, if you don't... No, but the point is, if you think about it...
He was just depressed.
Yeah, if you think about it, whatever Shaul's ailment is, it's very mysterious. It does not appear to have manifested itself until he lost the monarchy. In other words, all of those episodes came after the Amalek episode in which he was stripped of his monarchy. And one can understand what's going on at that point. Because remember, it's not just the loss of position. It was essentially the loss of divine inspiration, the loss of prophecy. There were many spiritual losses that had come to him. So I don't think we could suggest that he lost the monarchy because of that instability. I think the instability was a consequence of the trauma of being stripped of that job. Remember, Shaul didn't want the job in the first place. Shaul started off as a very humble person who did not want this greatness. But as sometimes happens, we become wedded to that power and we're not able to surrender it. But you see the difference? So Shaul passes the buck and evades responsibility. When David is confronted with Natan, and Natan says, "Ata ha'ish, you are the man," David responds with only one word, "Chatati, I have sinned." No explanation, no attempt to minimize what he's done. So you see, there's also a profound idea. A person should not necessarily be penalized because they failed. People make mistakes and people do wrong things. But we believe in Shiva, of course, and if a person acknowledges the guilt and takes the responsibility and is willing to go on, there is room for forgiveness. But until there is that assumption of responsibility, no Shiva is possible. The first step in Shiva, both between man and God and man and man, is at least to have the recognition that you did something wrong. You know, until one has that recognition, there can be no tshuva.
Most people can't do that. After he said, "I've
sinned." We're talking about David, not Saul.
David.
Yeah.
Well,
Well, yes, because keep in mind that the Mashiach still comes from David's, and there are Tehillim that were written after that point, and after David, and allowed him to remain king. That's a sign of God's forgiveness. Well, that's correct. That's correct. There's no record of a similar incident happening again. Yeah, of course, David had many concubines. I mean, David was not married to a single woman either. He did not have as many as his son. Shlomo had 1,000 wives, but David had 18. Yeah.
So wasn't Saul's, he stayed in power after the first time that he failed to kill the...
Yes, but he was a lame duck, essentially.
But then he continues on, and what really does it to him for him is when Samuel... when he offers a sacrifice before Samuel tells him it's time to do so.
The crowning of the... It's a little confusing because on one hand, after Amalek, he's already told that he's lost it. But then God tells him again after that incident. It's not clear what the relationship of the two incidents are. Some say that his seed would have at least been vice president or would have had some secondary position, and that was stripped from them as well as a result of the second incident. But it was Amalek that primarily took away that right to be a melech.
I want to lose track of the
16
verses.
Yeah. Oh, you want me to just continue? Okay.
I do want to hear those before I go.
Yeah. Okay, so we just finished the list.
But this lady had a comment.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have a comment? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
Suppose there is a mental illness of some severity. Certain mental illnesses carry with them lifelong struggles whether or not medication is used. And since the shaman bears an active role, not just a passive role of knowing somebody, but is an active intermediary, could you talk a little bit more about how make that decision, whether or not...
Well, I would say absolutely the following. Every single case and every single illness is very, very distinct, and it's almost impossible for me to give a general rule here. But I would say the following. There is no reason to disclose things up front before a man and a woman meet. Because after all, if I have not met somebody yet, and I have not seen their good qualities, and I'm given a report that they had a mental illness, 25 years ago, I might as well say no. Why should I invite myself into trouble? When, however, there has been a certain amount of getting to know each other, and things appear to be getting heading in a somewhat serious direction, then it would be very, very important to have a consultation with the person who has that condition and discuss whether they feel comfortable disclosing it, and optimally they should be the ones who disclose it. If they adamantly refuse, there might be some very serious halachic question whether you would have an obligation to intervene. But my point is, in many cases, I think it's unnecessary to bring up negative points when it's very, very early in a relationship. Because if there's not much likelihood it's going to develop into something, then I don't think it's right to throw something negative. We're putting water on a fire that just, is just beginning. But it's very, very difficult. You may find yourself, the shadchan may find herself or himself in the very uncomfortable position of having to actively make disclosures, even over the objection of somebody.
Because most cases are young people. You're not talking about something that's 25 years ago. You're talking about somebody who's 19, 20.
I understand. I understand, but people are entitled to know certain types of information. On the other hand, the shadchan, if the shadchan is a lay person, they should not purport to be able to identify exactly what the scope of a mental illness is. In other words, doctors need to be consulted regarding how manageable is the condition. Is it controllable? Does it rear itself up? These are important things. You can't rush to a snap judgment that this will be a permanent impairment if, in fact, it may not be. Right? So it's a very, very difficult. Now, I'm afraid I don't have any real helpful answer to give you, but it's something that one has to grapple with.
Genetic difficulties? Must they be revealed?
Yeah, I think so. Now, of course, you understand that this shades into another question, and that is, should people, this has nothing to do with Lashon Hara anymore, should people be encouraged to undergo genetic testing, to undergo that which might be hidden? For example, we now can identify genes for a lot of underlying conditions, and literally every few months we're going to discover new. We're in the Human Genome Project, which will map and sequence. Now, there are many genes which indicate a predisposition to certain illnesses that may not become manifest for 30, 40, you know, 20, 30, 40 years in the future, like Huntington's, other things like that. So what do you do? I discover that I'm a carrier for Huntington's, meaning to say that in 40 years there's a likelihood that I'll have a debilitating sickness. Is that a type of thing that gets disclosed? You know, people are using this information for abortion purposes, and that's a very, very disturbing. If you abort a child because of the, we're not talking about Tay-Sachs here, which is another issue, right. But do you abort a child because when they're going to be 45 or 50, they're going to undergo a very, very painful illness? First of all, in 40 or 50 years, there may be cures for all of this stuff. So how we go with genetic exploration is a difficult problem, but I will say that when there is a genetic defect that is already known by one of the parties, there is a duty to disclose it to the other party. That much, I think, is clear. Yeah.
What about professional effort? You work with somebody is going to hire this person, you don't like something about this person.
Well, excellent question.
All of this
goes into the principle of toilets, meaning to say, I am allowed to disclose information about a person if it's necessary to protect other people from harm. Now, that other people may include an employer who will suffer harm because of the incompetence of a particular worker. It includes students who may suffer because a teacher isn't very good. Granted, I'm hurting that person, but I'm hurting that person for the purpose of saving other people. Now, obviously you don't exaggerate. Obviously you don't say more negative things than you have to say. And obviously you try to accentuate the positives too. In other words, but there is a moral duty. I mean, listen, if you're recommending a teacher and you have some serious reservations that this teacher will not do a good job, will hurt students, you have a moral obligation not to lie about that. You know, this is what the Catholic Church does all the time. I mean, when they have these priests that are accused of sexual abuse, they just reassign them somewhere else. And, you know, what type of thing? You know, according to halacha, there's a clear obligation. You know, I don't mean deprive them of a job, but put them in an office where they're not in contact with children. And, you know, obviously that's where Lashon Hara is overridden by the need to protect third parties. So employment references are an area in which a certain amount of negativity is justifiable in the interest of protecting third persons from incompetence or harm. Yeah.
It must be hard to differentiate, though, between personal opinion, perhaps, and legitimate cause for concern. It just seems like it would be hard. Is there almost like a checklist?
Well, that which is opinion should be stated as opinion. You're very correct. You're very correct. And you can even say, this is how I view the situation, but others may disagree, etc. And I would also say, in cases of doubt, don't say it. You know, Theodore Roosevelt had a daughter in the White House. What was her name? Alice Roosevelt Longworth. She just died a few years ago in her late 90s. And she was a well-known gossip and party maker in Washington. So she had a little pillow, an embroidered pillow. And when she was older, it was hard for her to walk. She said, if you can't say something nice about somebody, come sit next to me. But we would say the older way of saying it, but if you can't say something nice, better not to say. But sometimes, you know, you do have to speak up.
If you get the advice of any attorney today in terms of references, you're told not to do it anyway. I mean, just say, yes, the person worked here, and from this day to this day, you're not...
You cannot give even a positive recommendation. You can't say anything. Is that because of the fear of libel? What's the...
Yeah.
Well, okay. But, you know, theoretically, libel is only if it's untrue.
Probably, you know, people can look into, you know, any facts you've kept about them at work. You know, all the files now open. If you recommend somebody, they'll, you know...
So there's no such concept as employment recommendations today. That is a dead category.
Well, I don't know if you try to get information from them, but your it's recommended that you do not.
It's recommended, so I mean legally you could do it, but you run a risk.
You're even right.
Not only this, when you provide people with reference names, they're not allowed by the law to ask anybody else, but people still do it.
Sure.
And sometimes somebody will go over it.
That's actually, I haven't been following this area. That's a very interesting.
Capacity.
Yeah. In other words, I choose who you can ask.
Like I know somebody works with you, or somebody's in your...
Right, people ask informally, of course, yeah.
Informally.
Yes,
that's the question. What because do you do when you ask police informally?
Well, my answer once again is, you can be honest, but, you know, be objective too. In other words, try to separate out personal animosity. For example, there might be a lot of people that you don't like, right? But you still can acknowledge their strengths, and that's what you have to try to do. You know, I may not like somebody, but they run a classroom well, or they're perceptive, or they're scholarly, or whatever it is. So you don't have to mention I don't like them, right? You know. So you try to transcend the personal animosity that you might feel for whatever reason. Also, I'll point out this. It also appears that certain qualities, which might be observable very obviously, don't need to be articulated. For example, if the person has a negative quality, but they'll see it right away anyway, then you don't have to be the conveyor of lashon hara. A shidduch, right? Somebody has a bad nose. Right? You don't have to make the point. You know, he or she has a bad nose. You know? Don't see that. I mean, disclosure is for things that otherwise would not be noticed. There might be a reason to disclose. And besides, you know, things like that are very subjective. Anyway, you know, there's an interesting argument between Hillel and Shammai. It's very interesting. You know the song we sing at the Jewish weddings, Kate said, Marak Din, how do you dance in front of the bride? Yeah, the different stuff. But that's actually taken from a Mishnah. And listen, there's an argument between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. How do you dance and praise the bride? So Beit Shammai says, you got to be honest. You must say things that are true. Beit Hillel says, no, every bride is na'eh, is beautiful, v'chasudah, and pious. Every bride is beautiful and pious. And that's why we say the bride is beautiful and pious, even if she's not. Shammai was very reluctant to lie. Now, Shammai didn't say you'd sing that she was ugly or something, but Shammai says, you know, don't say things that aren't true. Hillel says there's a certain amount of exaggeration that is permitted. And the reason is very simple, because in the eyes of a loving husband or wife, the other one is indeed beautiful. That's a question of perception. It doesn't have to be what I feel, right? It's a question of what they feel about each other. And therefore, one should tap into that, and one should encourage that, and one should build up that. And therefore, it would be appropriate no matter what the situation is. And that's very, very true. These are very often subjective qualities in which the perception becomes the reality of the situation. If there is such a perception, now that is what it becomes. Okay, two more zechirot. Yes, sir. Let's see. Let's see if I can remember. Let's see. We have. Remembering the sin of the golden calf. That's actually in Parshat Ekev. Remembering how we angered God with the sin of the golden calf. We're supposed to kind of bear that burden on us. That is the fifth one. Let's see. I'm missing one here. Does anyone have a siddur, by any chance? Do we have a? Okay. Let's see. Remembering Shabbat. Remembering. Oh, yes, correct. Very good. Thank you. Yes. Remembering the Exodus. Remembering Yitziat Mitzrayim every single day. Thank you. Right. And that actually says Zachar. Okay? So these are, going back to the parsha, this was a long digression. Okay, yeah. You didn't want to forget. That's right, yeah.
I have one more quick digression.
Yes.
Back to this, it's bothering me, this midrash. How are we to understand the implication, that the Jews were God's last choice?
Well,
you know, to receive the
Torah. The way we understand it is really the opposite. The Jews were God's first choice, but he needed to be fair by giving everybody else the theoretical chance first. Meaning, God couldn't go to the Jews first, because if they would have accepted it, there'd be no room for anybody else to react. So really, it was the concept of God knew. See, again, this highlights one of the central enigmas in religious theology, which has no clear answer to this day, and that is, how do you reconcile free will with God's omniscience and God's knowledge of the future? God knew everybody would say no, and God knew we would say yes. But still, there was this theoretical element of choice which had to be played out in actuality. So it's not God's last choice. The Jews were asked last, but they were in fact God's first choice. God knew ahead of time that this would be it. Okay. So this is the Decalogue. This is the Matan Torah, the revelation of Sinai. Interestingly enough, the Torah never tells us when, what date this occurred. We know, of course, it happened on Shavuot, but it's interesting that the Torah does not directly say that. For example, when you read the Torah's description of why we celebrate Shavuot, you will recall it is exclusively described as an agricultural holiday. It is the holiday of the first fruits. It is the holiday of the wheat harvest. There is no mention of Matan Torah. It is only inferentially that the rabbis make a cheshbon that they left Egypt in Nisan and it took X number of days, took 50 days. Therefore, the Torah was given the 6th of Sivan. But it's almost accidental. Ironically, although in our prayers we say, what is Shavuot? Zman Matan Torateinu. The season of the giving of the law. That is not the way it is described in the Torah. Which is very interesting. The Torah emphasizes the agricultural element, although we today almost totally celebrate the holiday as the anniversary of Matan Torah. And part of the explanation that's given for that is the Torah did not want to attach too much importance to a calendar date. For example, we have in the American calendar Mother's Day and Father's Day. So one day a year you have to honor your mother, and then one day you have to honor your father. In the Jewish calendar, I remember years ago I saw a day that were called Children's Day. Do they still have that? I saw on a calendar something called Children's Day. Like a parallel of Mother's Day and Father's Day. Okay, I haven't seen that recently. I don't know. They took it out. Which day again?
Honesty Day.
Honesty Day. One day. Yom Kippur, right. But, so the thing is that we don't have a Mother's Day or Father's Day because we don't assign it to a day. We have the fifth commandment that says, thou shalt honor thy father and thy mother. Now, we find a similar idea of why the Torah, which is the holiest thing that we have, the Torah was not given in the land of Israel. The Torah was given chutz la'aretz. The Torah was given in a desert. The Torah was given on a mountain that to this very day remains somewhat anonymous. We do not know, although there is a mountain that is identified as Mount Sinai, there's a monastery there. We do not know that that is Mount Sinai.
There's a big article about being Saudi Arabia.
It's very possible.
Yeah,
it's very possible. They found gold, really?
Well, they said they think that that's...
Well, that would be very interesting. But, and of course, we know that Mount Sinai, wherever it is not a shrine. In other words, it's not a holy mountain. So it's almost as if Matan Torah was deliberately removed from any notion of sanctified space. Matan Torah did not involve holy space. It involved non-holy space. Reason? Because the Torah wanted to teach us a lesson that Torah is not connected inevitably with geography. Now granted, living in Eretz Yisrael is very special. Yerushalayim is special. Beit HaMikdash is special. Obviously, we have a concept of sacred space. That's clear. But a Jew should not feel that their connection to Torah is exclusively a function of a certain makom. Torah is lemala min hamakom. Torah transcends geography. And this is implicit in the fact that Matan Torah occurred in Chutz La'aretz, in a place that was not later sanctified or memorialized. You see, if God would have made Mount Sinai a shrine, that would have defeated the whole message of why Mount Sinai was chosen in the first place. Mount Sinai was chosen because it's an insignificant location. So if you make it significant, you're undermining the purpose of its choice. Well, some commentaries want to suggest that the same argument that God wanted to show that Torah is not linked to place, God wanted to show that the observance of Torah is not linked to a special day. If God would have said, for example, you celebrate Matan Torah on Shavuot, that would have made Matan Torah like a Mother's Day or a Father's Day. But by not linking it to a particular date, the Torah makes the message of Matan Torah a very universal message. Although we do commemorate it as it runs throughout, but the Torah does not emphasize that point. In fact, there's another nuance here as well. In our tefillot, in our prayers, we call Shavuot Zaman Matan Torateinu, the day or the season of God giving us the Torah.
And not accepting.
Right. Why don't we call it Zaman Kabbalat Torateinu, the day of accepting the Torah? The answer is Matan Torah may have been a single event. God gives the Torah. Kabbalat HaTorah is a process that one undergoes every single day of their lives. Every day, every moment, one makes a choice. Are they committed to live by God's law or not? Every time we have a temptation, should I lie on my income tax return? Should I cut corners on something? Do I respond to a provocative situation with anger or resentment? Or do I do the good and the noble thing? We are making choices at that moment. Do I want to live by God's values? Or do I reject God's values? Kabbalat HaTorah cannot be tied to a moment in Jewish history or even to a moment in the life of an individual, because it is a moment-by-moment process that we go through, and that process is never over. So it's very beautifully expressed by the fact, Matan Torah, Kabbalah Torah is every day. In fact, I once thought that this might be an explanation of something in the liturgy. The brachot that we make in the morning. So one of the brachot is, at least in the Orthodox and Conservative Siddur, is Shelo Asani Goy, that God did not make me a non-Jew. I will not talk about Shelo Asani Isha. We'll leave that for some other discussion. But people ask the question, why don't we express this in the positive? Sho'asani Yisrael. Now, some Sidurim have, in fact, changed it to the positive. Yes, there is a newer version that had that. Sim Shalom has in the positive. But the original version, clearly, or at least the traditional version, clearly espouses the negative and not the positive. And I think there is a certain profundity in that, because the concept is the following. You cannot tell God, thank you, God, for making me a Jew, because you make yourself a Jew. Meaning, the most you can say is, God gave me the potential to actualize myself into a Jew, Shelo Asani Goy. So I'm a tabula rasa, so to speak, meaning I come into the world as a blank slate. But how I fill the contents of my life are a function of my choices. So you don't tell God, God, you made me a Jew. No, we make ourselves a Jew by how we behave.
Okay, bracha that you say for an aliyah, where you say no shame on Torah.
Yes.
Okay, so does that connote that God is constantly revealing, or that we are constantly revealing?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. No, Tena Torah is also present. God, although again, in Hebrew it's a little ambiguous, because notein can be a noun form as well as a verb form. So is the translation of notein haTorah, who gives the Torah, or the giver of the Torah, in which case it does not necessarily have to have a present connotation. So that's one thing to look at, because notein in Hebrew, the noun form takes on the hoveh, takes on the same as the present tense. But even so, I think you have a good point. It may connote some notion of continuous revelation, and it may connote the idea that God revealed himself, but we're always open to receive new things from God, and therefore it goes back to the Kabbalah HaTorah. Yeah?
It's related also, in my mind, to Yeshayahu, the way he describes the position of Korah, which says, we are automatically holy. The whole people is holy, and therefore, for instance, what is Moses, the story. But the the non-Korach response is to say it's only through the taking on of the responsibility of the vote
yes.
that we strive toward holiness. It's a process that we participate in through this effort. It's never something that's just given to us.
Right.
That's something that's as active today as it is in the year.
Right. No free lunch, so to speak. Now, of course, Dr. Liebowitz takes an extreme view, I think, of that, many things, but his extreme view is he says there is no such thing as intrinsic holiness. This is Shiloh Liebowitz's view. Holiness is merely the result of the actions that you do in assuming God's covenant. I think it's a little extreme because it seems the way we normally describe it is there is indeed the inchoate potential holiness that is there. It doesn't become actualized. We would differentiate between intrinsic potential holiness and its actualization. He actually denies there's such a thing as potential unactualized holiness.
And I think the reason for it on his account, I don't want to think for him, but it seems that the risk of complacency is so great. And we see if the non-religious world is replete with sins of many kinds, the religious world's temptation is to consider itself already somehow presently holy. That's the risk that I think we see.
Well,
it makes a good case, but
the risk of arrogance, the risk of hubris, the risk of all of these things of self-righteousness. This is from another religious tradition, but the seven deadly sins certainly fall within the Jewish tradition as well. And that's really a great sin. The Baal Gava, arrogance and false conceit, is considered to be the gravest of all sins, and that is a form of idolatry, because you're putting yourself in the center of the universe at that point. They tell a Hasidic story of the Maggid of Meserich about one of his... The Maggid of Meserich, if you have my Hasidic class, you know, is a disciple of the Hashem Tov. He was the successor of the Hasidic movement, a very extraordinary, unusual individual. In fact, the best analogy that comes to mind, and I hate using this, but it really is such a perfect analogy, is what Paul was to Jesus, meaning to say Jesus was a religious leader, but he had no organizational skills, so to speak. And Christianity as a movement, the great galvanizer of Christianity, was Paul. And the same thing, the Baal Shem Tov was a charismatic leader, but his disciples were a small group of people. The Maggid of Meserich was a genius at organization, and he literally made the Hasidic movement into tens of thousands of followers in his lifetime. Anyway, the story goes that the Maggid of Meserich once had a disciple who was knocking at the door late at night, and the Maggid asked, "Who is it?" And the disciple said, "It's me, it is I." Thinking the Maggid would recognize his voice. Because when you said, "It is I," you have to realize there is no I in the world except for God. God is the only Anochi. I implies I'm a separate being, I'm autonomous. Even in English, I is capitalized. I was just thinking today, why is I capitalized? You is not capitalized. When I write about you, or her, or him, that's a small letter. When I write I, it's a capital letter. Why is that? It's a very egotistical way of looking at the world, that, you know, when it comes to me, you know, that has to be a big letter. And the Maggid of Meserich tells his disciple, there is no I in the world. And until you learn there is no I, and that's when you said, it's not me, it's not me, it's not me. That was a tikkun, that was a rectification for that attitude. You know, so certainly the sin of arrogance is great, and ostensibly, the more externally righteous a person is, in terms of ritual and mitzvot, the more prone they are to that type of arrogance, which is very, very destructive and very, very evil. So these are the sheish sechiyot, and again, I segued into this simply because this is where the mitzvah of remembering Mount Sinai is introduced, and the reason why it's important is every day we renew our commitment to God. Every day. And that's very important because what it reminds us is that our Judaism has to be a process of growth. If we compare Judaism and our the life of a religious person as a ladder which we try to ascend, the important thing in God's eyes is not where you are on the ladder, but in what direction you are heading.
Are you heading upwards, or are you going down? I'd like to recount Franz Rosenzweig's well-known remark. Rosenzweig, toward the end of his life, became a more observant Jew. That's very interesting. The story goes he was on the verge, because of his professional career, of converting to Christianity. Because, you know, in German universities, just if you wanted to be a professor, you basically had to be a Christian. So there were many Jews who were not practicing Christians, but they were not practicing Jews either, so they figured they went through conversions just so they could get their job. So Rosenzweig was on the verge of going through a pro forma conversion to Christianity because, you know, he wanted to be in the academic world. But he decided, like, to stop off at a synagogue as his last, you know, time he would experience a Jewish service. And he happened to walk into a synagogue on Yom Kippur. And everyone is dressed in white. And I'm not sure if this was an unusual synagogue or just he was an unusual person. I have a feeling it may have been the latter. Probably it was a regular synagogue. But somehow the vision of people in white and the prayers and the tshuva just made him realize for the first time what it meant to be a Jew. And it basically changed his life. And towards the end of his life, he actually became somewhat observant. At this time, he was already stricken with a neurological disease. I'm not sure if it was muscular sclerosis or not, but he was very ill and partially paralyzed. And he was asked by an acquaintance whether he put on tefillin, did he put on the phylacteries yet? And his response was, not yet. And the not yet response is very profound. If he would have said no, that would have been true. But no is the notion of closing the door. My life is a closed book. Not yet is the acknowledgement that life is a process and we have to be open to the opportunities of growing in our relationship to God. Now, not yet is so wonderful because not yet is a great common denominator that every Jew can join with every other Jew. Even the most observant and devout Jew should have a not yet in their life. What do you mean? You're perfect? What do you mean not yet? In other words, there's a not yet. I'll try to be, you know, more careful about Lashon Hara and arrogance and not looking down at people. Another person's not yet will be, I'll try to keep Shabbat a little better. Right? In other words, not yet is the common denominator that acknowledges the imperfections of human beings and the fact that people have to strive for the process. So a no is a no-no. Right? No says, that's it. I am what I am. Only God could say, I am what I am, right? And even God, right, in this parsha, it's mistranslated. Ayah, sher ayah, does not mean, I don't know why the term, I am what I am. Ayah means I will be what I will be. Even that name is a process of becoming. God himself refers to the process of continuous revelation and involvement. It does not refer to a static notion of God. Now, of course, what that means, I'll have to leave again, leave for another time. On one level, God is static in the sense that God's essence is unchanging. God doesn't grow bigger, so to speak. But in God's manifestation, there's an infinite variation of how human beings perceive God, how they relate to God, the dimensions they see and the richness of their relationship with God. That is an evolving process. The story goes about Rav Sadia Gaon, one of the great rabbis, that Rav Sadia Gaon was doing tshuva once. He was crying over something. So one of his disciples said, what are you crying? What aveirot have you done? So Rav Sadia Gaon gave a mashal. He said, I once went to an inn, and the innkeeper did not recognize me as a prominent rabbi. So, you know, he gave me a room, gave me a meal. Everything was fine. The next day, he found out who I was, and he was begging my forgiveness. And I asked him, why are you begging forgiveness? You did nothing wrong. He says, yes. But had I known then what I know now, I would have done much more for you. Rav Sadia Gaon said that every day he felt he was growing in his appreciation of God. So he's doing tshuva today because he says, if I would have known you like I knew you yesterday, I would have done more. That's called, that's even in rabbinic literature, that is called the special tshuva of Rav Sadia Gaon. That is the tshuva, which is not so much a tshuva of sin, but a tshuva of renewal as one recognizes their you know, superior perceptions. And that's the ideal, it's an ideal, not that none of us ever have this on a constant level, but this is the ideal trajectory of life in which there is this continuous growth in areas. And I have to say that it's a major, major failing, even among people who are very observant, and perhaps more so among people who are very observant, to kind of feel that they have arrived, and therefore further growth is something that becomes less necessary. And that's not true at all. In fact, going back to something in my Hasidic class, although I don't think I actually mentioned this in that class, Rav Shneur Zalman, who was the founder of the Hasidic that we know as Chabad or Lubavitch, but Rav Shneur Zalman was a great disciple of the Magid of Nezirich. So because he was very articulate and very scholarly, he was often chosen to be the representative at these public disputations. You know, in the Middle Ages, the public disputations tended to be between the Catholic Church and the Jews. But at the beginning of the Hasidic movement, the Hasidim were often summoned to public disputations with Mitnagdim. And one of the accusations that was hurled against the Hasidic movement was a teaching of the Baal Shem Tov that even a tzaddik must always do tshuva, must always repent. And the accusation was made, you are demeaning the righteous man by saying that the righteous man must repent, because the tzaddik has no real serious sin for which he must repent. And Rav Shneur Zalman explained this idea, he didn't use Rav Sadia Gaon, this idea that tshuva does not necessarily mean I did something bad and therefore I must repent, but tshuva is the process of becoming more than you were, the process of transcending your limitations, the process of growth, the notion of going beyond yourself. And the witnesses to this encounter talk about how Shneur Zalman himself became very inflamed with passion as he talked about the true sign of the righteous person is that he's not static, in that he moves forward. And he even talked about that was the meaning of the burning bush. Moses sees the burning bush and Moses says, I must turn away from where I am and approach this bush. Now, what the bush represents, there's many standard understandings. According to one interpretation, the burning bush represents the Jewish people themselves who are lowly and oppressed like the little bush, and the fire of persecution tries to destroy them, but the bush doesn't get burnt, right? That's the standard interpretation. Another interpretation is the burning bush is reminiscent of Mount Sinai, which is consumed with fire. But the Shneur Zalman said, the bush represents the common Jew. The Jew who doesn't have fruit, doesn't have pretense, doesn't have height, does not have gravitas, does not have weight. And the fire represents the passion and love in the heart of the simplest Jew to reach out to God, which of course was one of the great teachings of the Baal Shem Tov. And when Moshe sees this, Moshe of course is the height of spirituality and holiness, sees this, Moshe says, I want to recapture some of that fire, some of that passion. Because the one thing that the simple Jew has over the righteous is perhaps the simple Jew knows that they're in the process of becoming. And the tzaddik runs the risk of thinking he's arrived. And therefore Moses says, this is what the Rav Shneur Zalman says, I must approach that bush and emulate its ways. Take from the Jew the notion of becoming, of process. And in fact, again, I'm going far afield, but I think this is important. Let's go back to another symbol of this, the lulav and the etrog. Again, all of us know the well-known symbolism that the lulav and the etrog represents the four types of Jews. The etrog, which has a pleasant fragrance and a good taste as a fruit, represents the Jews who study the Torah and keep the Torah, that's the fruit. And they have the fragrance, that's ma'asim tovim, they do good to others. The lulav, which is a date palm, dates, have sweet taste, they do Torah and mitzvot, but they don't necessarily give of themselves to others. The hadassim, the myrtle, has a pleasant aroma, the Jews who are good to others and kind, but do not keep the commandments. And finally, we have the lowly arava, the willow, which doesn't have taste, doesn't have smell, the Jews who do nothing at all. And yet on Sukkot, we have to take them all together. Right? That's the idea of unity. However, here's the point. On the seventh day of Sukkot, after you put away the lulav and the etrog and the hadas, the one thing that remains with you is the willow. right? There's a ceremony about the willow, that you hit the willow, etc. So it's a funny thing. If the willow is like the least credible of the four, like why does the willow have a special ceremony? Now, there's a positive way of looking at it and a negative way of looking at it. The negative way of looking at it is like this. What you're doing is, you just had a Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, and you've had all the good Jews trying to change this willow around. And we say, if this willow is still a willow, after all the work we put into him, then we'll give him some clap. We'll beat him a few times and get him in line. So some look at it as a way of saying, you know, if you're still recalcitrant after all of this process, you know, you need to get beaten a little bit. But the positive way of looking at it, which I think is more encouraging, is that the one thing the willow is pure process. The willow, above all, cannot take pride in what it's done because it hasn't done anything. So what does the willow offer to God? The willow offers to God its potential to become. And in effect, what we say at the end of Sukkot is, some Jews are closer to Esrog Jews, and some Jews are closer to Lulav Jews, and some Jews are closer to Hadas Jews. But every Jew, even the Esrog Jew, and the Lulav Jew, and the Hadas Jew, is really an Arava Jew, because there is some aspect within us which needs to become, which isn't there yet. So the Arava becomes the great symbol for all Jews. In other words, literally, this is the not yet approach. The Arava is the not yet Jew. But who is the not yet Jew? Every Jew is a not yet Jew, because every Jew has an aspect in their life which is not yet. Okay, so the Arava symbolizes the fact that all of us have that common, or should have that common denominator. And again, this goes back to our point that Shavuot is not called, it's not called Kabbalat HaTorah, it is called Matan Torah. Kabbalat Torah is the process of constructing the life that we built. 11 o'clock? Okay, I think I do have to stop now, but in Yitzhak Hashem, next week we will continue with the Beit Hanan. I would hope, although our pace is a little slow, but I would hope that we would finish the parsha. So please have a chance, if you have a chance, to look at Perek Dalet and Perek Hei, okay, two chapters in the book of Devarim. Okay, have a good day.
I'm not sure I got the six remembrances. I had Sinai, Miriam's statements about Moses.
Right. Amalek. You have Amalek, remembering the evils of Amalek?
That's the one I missed. And then I had Shabbat, the golden calf, and the Exodus.
Great. That's six. Got it.
Amalek. One other question. You talked about the Talmud, and then you said the Maharal.
Maharal.
What?
Maharal.
Maharal.
You want to know who the Maharal is?
Yeah.
Okay. Maharal is an abbreviation for Moreno, our teacher, the Rabbi Leif. That was his name. The Maharal was a medieval rabbi who was the chief rabbi of Prague, Czechoslovakia, in the 1500s. So he's way after the Talmud. And he's one of the great Jewish philosopher mystics.
Rabbi of Prague in the
1500s. In fact, in Prague, if you ever visit Prague, you can see the Maharal's shul, the shul of the Maharal. He wrote many, many works on Jewish mystical philosopher. It's hard to describe him exactly. He's not totally a rationalist philosopher, he's not totally a mystic, but he's a blend of mysticism and philosophy.
The Golem was his
product. I'm talking about the Golem.
Thank you.